narcolepsy and snoring and problems where people have trouble sleeping and are sleepy during the daytime. But we take care of people with night shift problems and jet lag and any sleeping problem that comes up. Because of reasons of the sun and being able to see things and do things, certainly I think, you know, from evolution, we're diurnal and like to be awake during the daytime. There's certainly individual variation in those things, but in terms of having somebody have a biologic predisposition towards being awake at night, that certainly can happen, but it's not the more common thing. Definitely the way the brain uses the nighttime to regulate hormones and biologic functions, clearly we've evolved to be awake during the daytime. And that's been over, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of years. There's no question that with the advent of electricity and the fact that society, there's always people up, awake, doing work at night, and doing shift work, that, you know, society and electricity have evolved much more rapidly than humans could. The body, in order to rest properly, likes to have a certain period of time where you do sleep. And that's because sleep is actually a complex physiologic process that involves, you know, biochemical changes in the brain in terms of getting restful sleep and the electrical activity that we see in the brain waves during sleep, and also in terms of hormonal regulation of a variety of different body systems, whether it's, you know, cortisone secretion by the adrenal gland, growth hormone, because the largest amounts of growth hormone secretion come at night in growing children. So that sleep is a complex physiologic process, and that's why it's highly regulated and why people tend to feel better if they're sleeping at night when it's dark and awake during the daytime. If you want a framework to work with, then the framework I would give you to structure this in is, you know, what's the optimal schedule for someone to have? And the optimal schedule depends on a combination of what we call Zeitgebers. And a Zeitgeber is a time giver. It's German. And a Zeitgeber, the most important Zeitgeber is bright light. And that makes sense because the sun is the one that we've used for, you know, a long time. The other Zeitgebers are social cues, meals, exercise, things that we get used to using as time-giving clues. Now, the two most common circadian rhythm abnormalities that we see commonly in people are shift work and jet lag. In shift work, what happens is that the bright light is during the daytime, but you're working at night and you're trying to sleep during the daytime. So there's a tug of war between the work schedule and the bright light. Additionally, the social cues are kind of mixed as well. When you're working and you're awake at night but sleeping during the daytime, you orient your social cues in a certain way, but the bright light is still during the daytime. And then when you aren't working, many people then say, well, I'm just going to go back to what everyone else does. And so your body doesn't quite know whether your internal clock should be night shift or daytime. The reason that people have so much trouble when they do shift work is because they don't get their bodies into any one time shift. The healthiest approach to shift work is to actually always have the same sleeping schedule. Where you run into major problems is when you try and shift from a weekend with the family and kids to the weekdays working at night. And then you're always trying to shift between one schedule and the other. And what commonly happens to people is that they're not really synchronized with either schedule. So they're always fatigued and they're always tired. Their sleep is probably not as restful as it could or should be. Possibly their quality of work is not as good as it could or should be. And also, you know, the quality of life with the family may be impaired as well. And that's a harder question because there your shift work is sort of in competition with what everyone else in society and your immediate circle of family and friends is doing. And what commonly happens to people who do shift work is people with mind over matter can do it, say, in their 20s and 30s and maybe even in their 40s. But most people, by the time they get to their late 40s or 50s, physically it's just too much stress unless you permanently alter your schedule in the way that I described. And then your biochemical regulation can stay in a much better synchrony with what sleep is supposed to be. From a medical point of view, what we would tend to be the most concerned about in something like this would be people who had chronic sleepiness or chronic fatigue and the consequent irritability from those things. And chronic fatigue and sleepiness certainly can lead to things like depression. It could lead to problems with, not being motivated, not enjoying work or home life. And we would also worry about the possibility of automobile accidents and job-related accidents or errors and the consequences of those things. If somebody really wanted to try and avoid some of those issues, generally what I would say is it sort of would have to be individualized. Many people with shift work end up using, lots of coffee and caffeine to stay awake. Clearly, coffee and caffeine will worsen some of these problems, and it's probably best to try and avoid those things. Alcohol as well, to help them fall asleep at certain times or relieve the stress of the job. And I think as much as possible, avoiding caffeine and avoiding alcohol is probably for the good in those situations. And just drink regular water, which hopefully, depending on where you get your water, is reasonably healthy. I guess the only other thing I would add, and this is sort of just in the global sense of, the society at large, the more people who do work and activities at night, the more some of these problems with night shift work or night shift syndrome can become prevalent. And, we certainly talk about larks and owls, and there's definitely a cliche about larks are people who are morning people and like to get up and get busy. And owls like to get up late, and they like to have more activities in the night. And both larks and owls, because of their either being up and exposed to the light early or sleeping late and being more, up at night, they definitely reinforce their own behaviors that, then the owls get used to staying up more at night. And you can certainly adapt to that. And I think many people function reasonably well. We're really talking about the people who have major problems from this and, deserve some serious consideration of how to alleviate those problems because of it.
When you live in a big city, you forget about night. There are things not to do after nightfall. Flash your wallet, leave your car unlocked, and people to avoid. The drunks, the crazies, the predatory. And every city has its wild sides where you don't walk. But much the same rules apply during the day, and in a curious way, cities are more easygoing by night than by day. The dimensions of night, nighttime, night space, seem larger. The crowds are thinner, the pace is slower, the parking easier. And after a certain point of no return, people even become friendlier. Maybe because there are fewer. Maybe because insomniacs have a Freemasonry of their own, and there's a companionship in being up and about while the rest of the world sleeps. Down in the London Underground, trains wait longer between stations to give stragglers a chance to get home. Voices are louder, more animated, and occasionally you can hear laughter, something that never happens during the day when everyone is grimly intent on going places and doing what has to be done. Night in the city is time out, time for leisure and intimacy, family and lovers, hobbies and pastimes, reading and music and television. It is also the time for excitement and celebration, theaters, movies, concerts, and party going, wining, dining, dancing, and gambling. For people who hold down boring and unsatisfactory jobs, night is the time when they feel they lead their real lives. A century ago, the pioneers of the American labor movement defined the decent life as 8 hours work, 8 hours sleep, and 8 hours for what you will. Now the times for sleep and what you will have merged together. Day shift and night shift are interchangeable, and night has become the continuation of day by other electrical means. Like the brain, however, the city only seems to sleep. Scattered across its darkened cortex are bright points of activity. In police stations, hospitals, newspaper offices, television studios, and whorehouses, the night shift is in place. Firemen and ambulance crews wait for a call. Disc jockeys jabber away in their sealed cubicles. Bakers pound the dough for the morning bread. The food markets are in full swing. The pubs and cafes around them are packed, and the watchers and listeners whose livelihoods depend on computers and satellites are busy at their terminals. Air traffic controllers, the defense establishment, the young tigers and tigresses in the financial district who monitor figures from the Nikkei and the Hang Seng. By the time the casinos close at 4 a.m., the streets are deserted and the city has shrunk. A crosstown journey that would take a sweating hour or more at rush hour becomes a pleasant 15-minute cruise. The maintenance armies are on the move, the office cleaners and service engineers. But invisibly, and out on the streets, there is only the eerie and natural silence of what Skye Masterson in Guys and Dolls called my kind of time, a couple of deals before dawn, when the echo chamber of the sleeping city falls quiet and you can hear the small details, a car changing gear in another street, footsteps, a far-off shout, barking dogs and amorous cats, leaves stirring faintly in the night breeze, the first uneasy notes of a waking bird.
Pump, pump, blow the dump, the steaming sewers. Take the chance that only chancy chicks would take and cakewalk home with icy breaks of spiky heels and clicks they make and walk through your cold neighborhood, but don't get raped, knock on wood. Martina hobbled home, breathing in time to the sounds of her footsteps on the pavement. All the houses made hushy silent sounds because it was a thick night at 3 a.m. Nobody was around. That's the worst time, a part of her said. But most of her just said vup, tup, vup, tup, vup, tup, vup, tup to her swinging legs. Pump, pump, blow the dump, the steaming sewers. Take the chance that only chancy chicks would take and cakewalk home with icy breaks of spiky heels and clicks they make and walk through your cold neighborhood, but don't get raped, knock on wood.
Have you ever been afraid of the dark?
No. Not really. How old?
Any age.
I have been.
Is it, what happens? Do you get afraid of somebody gonna get you, or?
I'll say something. I'm afraid in the dark when the windows, like the shades are up, and then I just look outside the window and I think someone's gonna just put their head up on
I'm worried about the creaks in the house and when people, you know, think about people walking in and kidnapping you and stuff.
Uh-huh. Every noise frightens you.
Uh-huh. What do you guys do when you get scared?
I either get up and see what's going on, read a book, or try and get to sleep.
I get up and see what's going on. I lock all the windows, close the blinds and go to sleep.
What I do is just, if my parents are gone and I'm home alone, I just watch TV and then I hear no one and I just don't, you know, get afraid or anything.
I'm June Madsen-Clausen. I'm a psychologist, a clinical psychologist, and I'm also an assistant professor here at the University of San Francisco in the Department of Psychology. Fear of darkness is not an uncommon fear in general. There are a lot of folks who are afraid of the dark. And as in other fears, when that fear gets to the point where it's interfering with a person's functioning, we call that a phobia, which is an irrational or excessive fear. It has a lot of different characteristics, and fear of darkness is one of the phobias that we know about. I think there are several factors that might lead to fear of darkness, and one of them, I think, is we could call it culturally induced in the sense that there may be an evolutionary advantage to being afraid of the dark. I mean, if you look at fears in humans, we are more afraid of things like water, being in closed places, fear of darkness, than we are of things like cars and bicycles and knives, when really cars and bicycles and knives are just as likely to harm us as those other things are. But it seems that there's some kind of culturally transmitted belief that comes from our ancestors, comes out of evolution, that we should be afraid of these things because they may be damaging to our species. So I think that's kind of a cultural transmission of fear of darkness, sociocultural transmission. But also there are kind of individual psychological reasons for being afraid of the dark, which can vary from individual to individual. But typically, fear of darkness is about fear of something else. It's about fear of what might happen in the dark. You know, for young children, they're afraid of imaginary characters or monsters, or they're afraid of the nightmares that they're going to have. You know, we're talking preschool, toddler, middle childhood. But as adults, we're also afraid of what might happen. We're afraid of our house being broken into and us not being able to see the person. We're afraid of someone being in our room already before we turn off the light, someone being in the closet, you know, stemming over from childhood, the boogeyman in the closet. So I think there are some psychological reasons, and particularly for people who have experienced any kind of trauma while it was dark. You know, then darkness becomes conditioned or associated with that trauma. We know that all children, like a developmentally appropriate fear around preschool age, 3, 4, 5, is darkness. And that lasts up through middle childhood, up to about age 8, 9, 10, somewhere in there. We know that that is, we call it developmentally normal because most children have that fear of the dark. Now, why it occurs is a really interesting question. I mean, I think there may be a protective mechanism to that in the sense that that is a period of time where children are developing some autonomy from their parents. They're starting to strike out on their own, to not always have mother within sight. And they may have some fear about that. That may be hard for them. And they may be kind of holding darkness up as the symbol of that fear. So when they're in the dark, mom really isn't there. Mom or dad, I'm using mom generically here, but the primary caretaker really isn't there. So I think that might be part of why they're afraid. Also, I think the way our society portrays darkness, you know, in the media, bad things happen at night. We communicate that to our children. Don't go out after dark. Bad things happen at night. Bad things happen after midnight. Things, we talk about things like that. Halloween is spooky once it gets dark. All of these things get communicated to kids. Monsters come out in the dark. Monsters hide under your bed and they come out after you go to sleep. You know, all these kind of imaginary, fanciful things that get communicated to children, as well as the real life violence and stuff that goes on in our society, mostly occurs at nighttime. So I think our children, from a very young age, get that, you know, incorporate that into their sense of the world. And so when the lights go out, all of those thoughts start invading their kind of their consciousness.
This is a song to be sung at night when nothing is left of you in the light, when the cats don't bark and the mice don't moo, and the nightmares come and nuzzle you. When there's blackness in the cupboards and the closet in the hall, and a tipping, tapping, rapping in the middle of the wall. When the lights have one by one gone out all over everywhere, and a shadow by the curtains bumps a shadow by the chair, then you hide beneath your pillow with your eyes shut very tight, and you sing. There's nothing sweeter than the middle of the night. I'm extremely fond of shadows, and I really must confess that cats and bats don't scare me. Well, they couldn't scare me less. And most of all, I like the things that slide and slip and creep. It really is surprising how fast you fall asleep.
The fear of darkness, as in all fears, tends to be more prevalent among women. In children, the gender distribution is not as different. It's more equalized in children. But adolescents and adults, women tend to more commonly experience these kinds of fears, at least at the clinical level. The literature is not as I don't know, is not as available at the kind of normal fear level in adults. Like most adults probably would prefer to be in the daytime than in the nighttime. But in terms of a clinical level, to the point where it's interfering with functioning, that's more common in women. as a therapist, how you conceptualize that fear, how you understand the cause of that fear. And when we think about the causes of fear or phobia, we think about basically three different possible causes. One I've already mentioned, and that's the evolutionary perspective, where it's just a naturally protective mechanism. You wouldn't necessarily treat that, because people don't shrug that off very easily, and that's not necessarily a bad thing to have. But if it's excessive, then we think of it as stemming from either from, in psychoanalytic terms or psychodynamic terms, an unconscious conflict or an unconscious fear, something that the person's not really aware of or not completely aware of, that they're afraid of, has been displaced onto this fear of darkness. So it's really not about fear of darkness. It's about fear of something else, fear of perhaps something that might happen in the dark, or memories of something that happened in the dark that they're not aware of. And the darkness is just symbolizing that. So the treatment for someone who conceptualizes it that way is to try and recondition the person to understand that the darkness is neutral. The darkness isn't actually causing any distress for them. It's the other things that have been associated with the darkness. So treatment involves gradual exposure to darkness, very slowly, in very small amounts of time, gradually exposing the person to darkness and showing them that they can experience darkness in the absence of fear. They're kind of rules about how to handle your fears, and they have to do with facing your fear. You know, a lot of people who have these kinds of fears avoid the thing they're afraid of. So they're afraid of the darkness, they avoid the darkness. They sleep with the lights on, they don't go into situations where they're not going to be able to keep it light. And so the treatment that they could do with themselves is to gradually expose them to this feared stimulus, you know, to set up like an appointment with their fear. You know, I'm afraid of the dark, I'm going to make an appointment with the dark. From 9 to 9:15 tonight, I'm going to be in a dark room. At 9:15, I can turn the light on, and in case I get really scared, my hand will be on the switch, and I can turn the light on at any time. But from 9 to 9:15, I'm going to try and tolerate this. And they can gradually extend that time, gradually increase their appointment time, their appointment with fear time, to the point where they're realizing that, hey, I can be 2 or 3 hours in the dark and nothing bad happens. It generalizes, and eventually they'll be able to sleep the whole night through.
Summer on to the endless night, end of the night, end of the night, end of the night, end of the night.
In San Francisco, at the far end of the Exploratorium, stands a three-dimensional maze through which one walks, climbs, crawls, and slithers in marmoreal darkness. The pliant walls give birth to you or fall away to a sloping floor or guide you to a sea of what feels like navy beans or leaving you grasping your way forward among rope hammocks. Now and then, your hand strays over a familiar shape, a brush, a sandal, which seems as startling as a flash flood. And then you return to the indecipherable dark again. A few people get violently claustrophobic and start screaming, and then a guard sneaks in to rescue them. But even people who aren't normally claustrophobic have moments of sheer panic when they wonder if they will indeed find their way back to the world of sight. The blackness is as perfect as solid rock, and the maze tumbles into slides too narrow to sit up in. You can feel the beginning of the slide and its rough dimensions, but not its length or how it might change farther on. How will it plunge? Suppose you get trapped midway, unable to lift your head or move your arms. If you go arms first to feel your way along, suppose it narrows and you are unable to back up. Suppose there is a drop at the bottom into a soft surface, which you will enter head first. Down you slide, hands overhead, somersaulting, free a few moments later. Crawling into a room that seems to have no outlet, you stretch high and discover a handhold, then climb blindly up and pull yourself to another level of maze. Something light and sticky brushes your face. The blackness becomes a solid mystery again, disorientating and full of blind alleys. The darkness pours its panic marbles under your feet, and you stumble at a speed into a quagmire of something dry but mobile that surges up to your knees, and then, heart pounding, you trip through thick rubber fringes, grab hold, and fall down a ramp into bright light.
as humans, we are very sight-dependent, and being in the darkness forces us to utilize our other senses, and our acuity in our other senses increases when we're in the darkness. We pay a lot more attention to sounds and smells and touch kinds of sensations in the darkness. So, you know, I think most of us would say that our visual sense is the most important to us, and it's the sense through which we get the most information. So when that's shut down, we feel more vulnerable. We feel as if we don't have all our wits about us because we don't have that accessible to us. And that certainly has something to do with why it is that we tend to fear darkness. I think people recognize it when it starts to interfere with their life, but rather than getting treatment for it or treating it themselves, people try to structure their life so they don't have to encounter it. So they, you know, do something simple like sleeping with the lights on, or they get an apartment or a house that has huge windows where the moonlight can shine in, or whatever it is that they do. They structure themselves so they work at night, so they're always in the light, and they sleep during the day. You know, they structure their lives so that they don't have to encounter the stimulus. That's the stimulus, which in this case is darkness, that's the more common response to an irrational fear. People don't tend to think of getting treatment because treatment means facing your fear, and that's really uncomfortable. That's really hard to do for people. I've worked with a couple of people who are afraid of the dark, and one of their coping mechanisms is to work graveyards or swing shifts and then stay up until it's dawn and then go to bed. And that didn't interfere with their life in the sense that they were able to hold down a job and make a living, but it, of course, impacted their social relationships in the sense that when you're working a graveyard shift and most of the world works a daytime shift, it really impacts your social relationships. As well as, you know, there are some biological studies that show that it's harder on your body, you know, to change your rhythms into that kind of structure.
Before the invention of electric light, night travelers had elementary forms of illumination. Burning torches or lanterns with panels of horn, specially treated and cut thin enough for candlelight to shine through. But lights of this kind did little more than intensify the surrounding darkness, and it is hard now to imagine what nightlife must have been like before the introduction of electricity, although sometimes, in forests or in countryside, deep enough and remote enough not to have even a smudge of city glow on its horizon, you begin to understand how touch and go even the simple task of walking home must have been. Or rather, not walking, but simply stumbling along potholed, muddy tracks, feeling your way through gradations of darkness in which every small noise becomes suddenly significant. Is it a sign of life? An unknown presence? Human or animal? Safe or threatening? The moon reassumes its traditional importance. It stops being a heavenly ornament, a decoration in the night sky, and becomes a blessed source of light and aid. Old clocks mark the phases of the moon, as well as the hours, not for decoration, but in order to help nocturnal travelers plan their journeys.
We would like to thank all of the people we interviewed, plus special thanks to Erica Lopez,
Rebecca Reese,
Arwin Moore, June Lee, and Alex Hatch. Readings were from How Night Came by Joanna Troughton, Middle of the Night by Carla Kuskin, A Day in the Night of America by Kevin Coyne, A Natural History of the Senses by Diane Ackerman, Celebrate the Solstice by Richard Heinberg, Night by A. Alvarez, and Martina by Marin Cadell. Music by Steve Reich, Fred Frith, Brian Eno, Pee Wee Creighton, Little Willie Littlefield, Bob Marley, Them, Thelonious Monk, Meredith Monk, The Doors, Jane Ira Bloom, and The Dells. This show was produced by Mary Salome and Emily Charles. Let me forget you.
And our thanks to them both for making audio evidence possible today on this, the winter solstice. The time is 2:59. You're tuned to KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, your listener-sponsored stations in Central and Northern California. Coming up after these announcements, Jack Foley, your host today for Cover to Cover on KPFA.
CJSF 90.1 FM wishes you a bright winter solstice.